Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hello, and welcome to Stephanomics, the podcast that brings the global economy to you. You couldn't write an economic history of the past 50 years without multiple mentions of Paul Volcker, who died this week at the age of 92. If you think about it, he played a key role in not one, not two, but three of the financial landmark events of the past half century. He advised President Nixon on the decision to leave the gold standard, which led to the collapse of the whole post-war Bretton Woods system in 1971. Then, most famously, as chair of the Federal Reserve for much of the 80s, he forced the US Central Bank to do what it took to confront inflation, even when what it took was a deep recession and a soaring dollar. And then he was still around in 2008, advising President Obama on how to cope with the fallout from the global financial crisis, devising new rules for banks, which remain in diluted form today. That's a massive legacy, which I'm going to discuss with Paul Volcker's co-author, Bloomberg's Christine Harper, in a few minutes. But first, India. Now, India is a lot to get your head round, even for so-called experts. You'll surely know that it's got more than a billion people living in it, but along with that it has 23 major languages, 85 political parties and 300 ways of cooking potato. It also has an ambitious Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, who, like President Trump, has thrived by breaking with traditional models of how a politician should behave. But now the economy's hitting trouble, and so is he. In a few minutes, I'll ask our India economist, Abhishek Gupta, whether Prime Minister Modi has the capacity to turn things round. But first, Bloomberg economy reporter Anirban Nag has this report from the diamond mines of West Central India.
Take diamonds, Hollywood A-listers, and a $2 billion fraud, and you have all the ingredients of made-for-TV scandal that had all India paying attention.
So there you have it, now Enforcement Directorate raiding the offices of Nirav Modi, the famous jeweler who's really at the center of this entire scandal at the Punjab National.
In 2018, police raided the offices of diamond mogul Nirav Modi to investigate an alleged scam involving fake guarantees and sham transactions. Modi, who's not related to Prime Minister Narendra Modi, was once a jeweler to the stars. He had boutiques in London, Hong Kong, and Mumbai. Nirav Modi has denied wrongdoing. He's currently being held in the UK and fighting extradition to India. Meanwhile, India's renowned precious stone dealers are still reeling from the repercussions.
After it was first alerted of the bank loot on the 16th of January, it took Punjab National Bank almost a month to understand the extent and gravity of an in-depth...
India's low-cost and high-skilled labour has turned the country into a hub of global jewellery. India exports 75% of the world's polished diamonds, according to the industry's Export Promotion Council, many of which end up in engagement rings and diamond bracelets sold at jewelers like Tiffany's.
Real is rare. Real is a diamond.
According to the government, the sector employs nearly 5 million workers, accounting for almost 7% of GDP. But the industry has been in serious trouble since the scandal broke. workers are losing jobs and businesses are shutting shops. If anything is to go by this way, Prime Minister Modi has little chance of achieving his goal of reaching $1 trillion in annual exports over the next 5 years. It's also weighing on the broader economy. So what went wrong? For answers, we went to the Diamond Hub of Surat. The city is a 3.5-hour train journey north from India's financial capital, Mumbai. It's home to over 1 million people employed in the sector, including the skilled artisans that polish the diamonds. Many of them migrate from elsewhere in India, attracted by the prospects of higher income. Babubhai Kataria started off as one such artisan about 4 decades ago, and he now heads the Surat Diamond Association. He wears a yellow and red thread around his right hand, an amulet worn by many of India's Hindus to protect someone from trouble. It's a protection that his industry really needs right now.
I have seen many slowdowns in my more than 40-year career in the diamond industry. The last time it was severe was in 2008, but conditions had normalized after a couple of months. But this time, the slowdown has dragged on for 7-8 months now and has hurt our business immensely.
Avadesh Pandey is a skilled artisan with nearly 2 decades of experience. 5 months ago, he reported to work at one of the thousands of diamond polishing factories, only to find the doors locked. The owner of the company had pulled down the shutters overnight and fled without telling any of his 40 workers. We were unable to track down the owner for comment. Pandey, who's 33, moved to Surat from across the country, following the footsteps of his elder brother. Before losing his job, he used to earn the equivalent of around $315 a month, roughly double the country's per capita income. But Pandey is now borrowing money from friends to pay the rent on his one-room house and the tuition for his 2 kids.
The owner shut shop without paying us our monthly salary. I have been roaming the streets in the past month and more trying to get another job. I leave in the morning and come back home in the evening, but no luck. Some factories say they don't have demand. Some say they don't have rough diamonds.
The outcry following the Nirav Modi scandal has created an atmosphere of distrust between banks and jewelers. Chirag Virani is a second-generation director at B. Virani & Company, a diamond cutting and polishing firm in Surat. He talked to us in his glass-walled office above the factory floor. Behind him hangs his MBA diploma from Canada's Ryerson University.
So liquidity crunches is one of the biggest problems that kind of has, you know, made this crisis even worse.
Yeah.
So because of these certain companies that do unethical practices, right? Bank have, I think all of a sudden they've said that we don't want to give credit to the diamond industry because there are many cases, you know, that...
In addition, the trade war between China and the US has put a dampener on sales, Virani said. While the US is the biggest consumer of Indian diamonds, a lot of stones transit through China for jewelry manufacturing or wholesale trading. With the US cutting its purchases of Chinese goods, the Indian gem industry has felt the impact. So although India is not part of any global supply chain, exports have been hit, dragging down overall economic growth to 4.5% in the third quarter, its slowest in 6 years. Back in Surat, it's hard times as employment in the industry has fallen and incomes for skilled artisans has been reduced by more than 70% in the past few months, according to industry groups. For Avadesh Pandey, the skilled artisan, it's a bleak and hard struggle, mirroring much of the slowdown in the economy.
I am so stressed right now. If this environment continues, then I'll have to consider leaving the industry and go back to the village and work in the fields for much less money.
For Bloomberg News, I'm Anir Banna.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
So Abhishek Gupta is Bloomberg's India economist. He's got a bit famous in the Indian market circles for disagreeing with other economists in Mumbai over what the Central Bank of India is going to do next. And I should say he's more often right than wrong. Abhishek, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Stephanie, for having me on the show. It's a pleasure.
So those of us who are not necessarily following every twist and turn of the central bank's policies or indeed the government of India's policies, you know, we hear that story there from Anirban Nag about how the diamond industry has been affected by trade wars and by the slowing of the Indian economy. If we step back from the day-to-day of central bank policy and what's going on month-to-month with the economy, you know, most people will have noticed, I think, when Narendra Modi came to office in India in 2014, he got re-elected again this year, there was a lot of talk about major reform and putting the economy on a completely different trajectory. We have seen reforms, but if you look at the state of the economy, it doesn't look that great. What's happened?
Stephanie, I think that's a great question. And indeed, if we look at Narendra Modi's track record over the last few years, he has certainly delivered on a lot of significant structural reforms, I'll say. But the way I think about these reforms is that they aren't necessarily growth enhancing, at least in the short run. They improve efficiency and productivity over the medium term. But what's exactly happening in the near term? For instance, let's just pick up one of the reforms, like Narendra Modi delivered on a new bankruptcy law for India. And under this law, what's happening is that, for instance, bad assets would now be changing hands. So from an old promoter to a new promoter. And sometimes things get delayed in the legal process. And stuff like this would negatively impact the economic activity of that six unit in the short run. And similarly for other reforms as well. In the short run, in the initial years of these reforms, there's a transition phase which kind of slows things down. Having said that, my sense would have been that over the past few years, things should have already started looking up by now, but that has not been the case. And I kind of put the blame more on not sufficient monetary easing rather than not more reforms. So clearly, I think monetary policy could have done a lot more to support government structural reforms parallelly, but that hasn't been the case so far.
Yeah, and it's true. You were very critical, and particularly of the previous head of the Reserve Bank of India. And when Modi effectively got rid of him, often when governments interfere with who's going to run the central bank, there's a lot of concern in the markets about the independence of the central bank being violated. But it was striking that there was not that kind of reaction from the markets when that happened, perhaps because investors agreed with you that the bank had been too tight.
Yes, certainly that has been the case. In fact, one of the key reasons holding back India's economy is the weak state of India's shadow banking sector. there are these non-bank finance companies in India which essentially are extending credit to consumers and housing finance companies. And these companies were quite negatively impacted due to a liquidity crunch which was created in the economy in late 2018 under the earlier RBI governor, Rajit Patel. Over the last year, the new central bank governor has reversed some of those policy mistakes, and we have seen credit spreads come down for the better rated companies, but some of the weaker rated companies, the credit spreads are still widening, and that is a financial shock that needs to be eased.
I mean, we heard a bit in that piece about the pain that some of that, the financial squeeze, is causing in the diamond sector and for some in that region. But obviously, this is an enormously diverse economy. The rural sector is particularly important, not just economically, but politically. If you're sitting in a rural area, how have you really felt the impact of Prime Minister Modi? Or maybe you haven't felt that much difference.
That's a separate discussion altogether. So, I mean, if you look at Prime Minister Narendra Modi's policies, he has also reinvented himself and his political party, the BJP, in terms of delivering more welfare-oriented policies for the rural poor. In fact, if you sort of talk about giving free gas cylinders and gas connections, that's been a very popular policy. Constructing toilets, that has been another major campaign of his. And besides that, he's also increased electrification in rural villages and opened bank accounts for the rural poor. And just this year, he had announced an income support package for farmers. So I think he has done a lot for the rural poor. However, the impact of that has been missing in terms of consumption. But broadly, the rural economy has benefited from Narendra Modi's policies. And if you speak to taxi drivers in India who kind of come from some of these rural villages in smaller towns, they do confirm that either they themselves and their families or their extended families, people have benefited from Narendra Modi's policies. So he is popular in rural India as well.
Hmm. That's interesting. I mean, I guess people from a distance will be wondering. I mean, he's a prime minister who's been controversial often outside of India for his treatment of people in Kashmir. He's violated human rights in some ways, or has been criticised for that. He's also not always been a fan of press freedom. I think investors have sort of weighed that against his ability to get the economy going. But how important is it for his future to really change the performance of the economy, or is he in a strong enough now position politically that he just needs to avoid a big recession?
I think that's a very important question that hits straight the point in terms of what will drive his re-election in 2024. If we look at the first year of his second term, he has had great success in terms of delivering policies and legislation that appeals to his majority Hindu voter base, be it, as you said, the abrogation of Article 317 in Kashmir, or the Supreme Court ruling in favor of a temple, or the current citizenship amendment bill, which just got passed yesterday in the parliament, which discriminates against Muslims. So all these kind of things do appeal to his voter base and have maintained his popularity with the masses. But my sense is that this is not what is going to count in 2024. And I think even he understands the importance of reviving the economy, because he had initially in 2014 run on the agenda of development, and he needs to bring economic prosperity and bring jobs for the young demographic force, which is coming into the job market. And that is why he has been focusing a lot on this $5 trillion economy.
Well, we will watch and wait. Abhishek Gupta, thank you very much.
Thanks.
I said something about Paul Volcker at the beginning of the program, who's died this week, but someone who got to spend a lot of time with him in the last few years is Bloomberg's own Christine Harper, who's editor of Markets magazine, but also wrote with Paul Volcker a memoir, Keeping at It, The Quest for Sound Money and Good Government, which only came out a year ago. Christine, I know you've written and had conversations with people in the last few days since Paul Volcker died. I guess one question to ask you is about the difference between the legend of Paul Volcker, who I certainly found quite scary the few times that I interviewed him, not least because he was so tall, and the man that you got to know in writing this book, because it didn't quite work out the way you thought it was going to go.
Yes, I would say that's true. And my understanding is that most people who have had some personal dealings with him have come away with the same conclusion, which is that he has this very forbidding public persona. I mean, if you look at the photography taken while he was Fed chairman, or the caricatures that were drawn of him, it was always as a sort of Olympian godlike figure glowering down at the mere mortals who were, you know, screwing up the planet. And so he did have this, he had this kind of Old Testament quality to him. But once you met him in person, he was absolutely a sweetie pie. He was one of those people who seemed like gruff and could use that fearsome persona to sort of achieve outcomes he wanted and take on, you know, people or institutions he felt weren't living up to their requirements. But he loved people, and he was actually quite shy, and he was very humorous, and he was unbelievably kind. So when I first met him, I was, I think like anybody, quite nervous. And he instantly won me over. He was very funny, loved telling stories, chuckled a lot, was always smiling. Nothing like what I expected. And as I got to know him more, part of what I really enjoyed talking to him was, of course, he had amazing stories about knowing everybody from, you know, the leaders of basically every country. He served under 6 presidents. You know, he's had this kind of incredible career, but he also loved to talk about the crossword puzzle, or he was a passionate home cook and he would talk about the recipes in the New York Times. And, you know, when he found a editing error, he would relish that he'd found something like that. He was really fun to be around and really pleasant and kind. And I think in some ways, you know, he stood for the people in what he tried to do publicly. He always put himself as somebody who wanted to take on corrupt influences and make the government better and make the economy better for the people. But he really did love people. He took the regular city bus to and from his office until he was 90 years old. He didn't put himself apart. He really saw himself as a public servant.
I thought I was smiling at one of the comments in the obituaries about him often having shiny suits. You could imagine the Wall Street people being a bit sniffy about him.
Oh, yeah.
Not having spent money on his suits.
When he was Fed chairman, you know, famously, he sort of got a little studio apartment in a building close to the Fed that was basically all, you know, college students living there. And he had, a table, a chair, a bed, and some milk crates. And he would take his laundry to his daughters, who lived nearby, to get it done every week. And, you know, that's because his wife was stayed up in New York and was quite ill, and she was taking care of their son, who had some disabilities. And she didn't want to move. So he just lived like this bachelor and flew back home every weekend. He really didn't care about things. I mean, I remember him once telling me he thought all of the furniture in his apartment, which was quite a nice apartment in New York that he bought at the bottom of the real estate market in 1973 or something, all of that furniture was probably, you know, 50 years old or something. He didn't really care. He cared about people. He cared about principles. He cared that society do right by people, but he wasn't materialistic. He wasn't selfish.
I was appalled. There was an event a few years ago that I was speaking at. It was a sort of private thing of people thinking about the global economy. And I was appalled when I saw the program that I was supposed to be co-presenting with Paul Volcker. And then I rapidly realized that it was actually quite liberating because it wouldn't matter at all what I said because people would really only be interested in what he said.
But what did you find? I mean, did you find that he was actually quite cheerful fun to be with?
And it was also increasingly he had... and we've spoken about this in the past. I mean, he was getting on, and he certainly, and he had his voice was definitely, you know, reflected his age. So sometimes when you're interviewing him, at least the first time I interviewed him, I found it sort of disconcerting that I was expecting this person to play a crucial role in whatever piece I was doing and deliver this great interview, and yet he seemed, you know, he was in his late 80s, and would he possibly deliver? But then, of course, the moment he started talking, you realised that he had not only really prepared for the interview, but had incredibly wise and sharp things to say that you wouldn't have got from anyone else. So I found it a pleasure that you had to, as you say, you have to get past that rather intimidating demeanour where he did often seem to be sort of scowling when I don't think he was. Look, we've talked a lot about the personal stuff, which I think is always important to remember, and a nice thing to remember this week. But of course people will also be interested, particularly since you got to know him in the last few years, of what his attitude was to the current members of the American administration, and particularly Donald Trump.
Yes, well, that was a constant source of frustration because I think one of the things about him that made him really different was that even though he could have a quite harsh judgment on certain things if he felt they were clearly wrong. Like, he had no tolerance for sort of people he felt were overpaid and, you know, enriched themselves at the expense of their customers or the public or you know, who corrupted institutions. But he was in many other respects this incredibly pragmatic and this incredible sort of tolerant person. So he wanted to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. So as much as, you know, I and I know other people were trying to kind of get him to come out and, you know, cast strong views on the situation, I think, you know, he served under six presidents. He served under Nixon. He served under, you know, LBJ and Kennedy. He'd seen a lot of things. And so he was patient in a way that not many people are. I do know that at the end, and, you know, he worked with me on a afterword for the paperback version of his book, He expressed more concern about the state of the world, you know, because in the book, he talked about how, you know, his mother had admonished him that things can look bad, but this country has gotten through a lot and will continue to be okay. But he wasn't so sure he believed that anymore. He was very concerned about those sort of forces of, you know, that were just sort of out there fighting facts, fighting science, you know, just, you know, with seemingly no concern about the good of the country and of humanity. And so, you know, he didn't like to name names, but I think he was very displeased at what he sees going on in the country. And I'll also say, you know, he was quite a fan of the Fed, but he was very disappointed in how they watered down the Volcker rule in the last couple months. He had sent a letter to Jay Powell warning him not to do that, and they went ahead and did that, and he was not happy about that. He thought that was a big mistake.
Yeah, the rule that had been the response to the global financial crisis kind of constrain banks from taking excessive risks. Well, Christine, thank you very much. I mean, I think that the overriding conclusion, and when you read all these obituaries, is what a consummate public servant he was. And I certainly hope that one of these days those kind of public servants will come back into favour.
Yes, I think that's more than anything what he wanted his legacy to be, is as an example for other people to follow into public service and into really believing that it was a noble calling, because he certainly felt it was.
We shall see. Christine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Stephanomics. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website, app, or wherever you get your podcasts. And for more news and analysis through the week from Bloomberg Economics, follow @Economics on Twitter. You can also find me on @MyStephanomics. The story in this episode was written and reported by Swansea Afonso and Anirban Nag. It was edited by Bruce Douglas and produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Special thanks to Abhishek Gupta, Christine Harper, and Nasreen Syria. Scott Lamman is the executive producer of Stephanomics, and the head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.